The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The signal, when it leaves the Zamyad, the vehicle, the pickup, and goes to the satellite and down to the war room, this takes 0.8 second. Then, of course, the sniper, even, you know, the most skilled one, has to take or will take some time to digest what he sees on the monitor and reach a conclusion and order the joystick what to do next.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 29th, 2021. Ronan Bergman is a reporter for the New York Times. He is the author of the book Rise and Kill First, which is a history of Israeli targeted killings. And most recently, with Farnaz Fasihi, he is the author of a lengthy New York Times investigative report entitled The Scientist and the AI-Assisted Remote Control Killing Machine, which is the story of the use of a ground-based robotic machine gun to kill an Iranian nuclear scientist. He joined me from Tel Aviv in the virtual jungle studio to talk about the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the operation and the machine through which it was conducted, the larger policy of Israeli assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists, and the legal bases on which these are done. It's a heck of a story, it's a heck of an issue, and it's a new frontier in targeted killing. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 29th, Ronan Bergman on the AI-assisted remote control killing machine. So I want to start with the story you and your co-author wrote on the assassination of the head of the Iranian nuclear program, because quite separately from everything else, it seems to mark a change in the way targeted killings can be conducted. To your knowledge, is this the first time any country has used a remote control robotic gun assisted by artificial intelligence to conduct a targeted killing?
Hi, Ben. Yes. The short answer is yes. As far as we know, this is the, of course, excluding the version of the Jackal, where they used the same kind of weapon. I'm just joking, of course, this was a fictional movie. But I think this is the first state-run assassination, or as far as I know, any assassination that used this kind of weapon, and used that kind of weapon not just in the sense of not having humans, not having operatives on the scene and using remote control robot killer, but also positioning the command room many, many, many hundreds of miles away, something that created, and maybe we should talk about this a little later, created another set of difficulties. And so after that happened, my great colleague and friend Farnaz Fasihi and our colleagues from Washington, Adam Goldman, Eric Schmidt and Julian Barnes started to collect the reporting, which 10 months after enabled us to publish this story at the New York Times last week.
So I'm interested in the sort of your sense of it as a philosophical innovation, because we've been, the United States and Israel alike, have been killing people from standoff robotic platforms for a long time.
Drones,
they are assisted by all sorts of algorithms, as well as ultimately controlled by humans. The algorithms allow them to fly independently, to take all kinds of sensor measurements, etc. And so what does it matter that this one is ground-based and a gun rather than a flying robot?
So, yes, you could say, well, what's the new modus operandi here? It is just a land drone. But it's everything but similar. Israel is using drones for targeted killings in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip that are stationed on its southern and eastern border, and did that quite frequently and does it from time to time today as well. But the people in Gaza are used to see Israeli drones as much as they used to see the sun or the moon. If a drone will start a voyage from Israel, and it needs to be quite a big one, Israel to Iran, there is a high probability that it will be taken down by the anti-aircraft defense systems, the Russians one that Iran uses, that's one. And second, if a drone started to patrol over this quite deserted aerial area above Absar, this is the village nearby the assassination took place, then probably the Iranians will figure out that something is happening there and got suspicion that someone is maybe planning to kill the person who is traveling through those roads every Friday. And another thing, not less important from the point of view of the planners, and this is collateral damage, the ability to control or to minimize the risk for collateral damage from aerial strike, as we just unfortunately saw in Afghanistan not long ago, that ability is very limited. While from ground, the chances to be accurate and hit only the target that was designated for this operation, those chances are much higher. And, you know, here is the proof is in the pudding. Only Mr. Fakhrizadeh was killed, not his guards, and not his wife, who sat just inches away from him, and not even the stray dog that coincidentally got into the line of fire. And I think this was when this operation was planned, it was very, very important for those who planned that to have zero collateral damage. It is one thing to bomb a building where a terrorist is trying to hide in, with sometimes unfortunate and tragic collateral damage. This is by itself a severe result, some would say illegal. But when you deal with a target that, as they use the coin, the terminology in Hebrew, has blood on his hand, or in that case, did not have blood on his hand. So it means a terrorist was involved in the killing of people. When you kill a scientist who is part of a sovereign scientific project of a sovereign government, I think that the aim was at least to make sure that only he is killed.
Okay, so let's talk about, I want to come back to the issue of the broader issue of killing non-combatant Iranian scientists, but let's start with the nature of the operation. You have in the story a remarkable amount of detail about the weapon in question. Tell us about the weapon.
Yeah, well, the weapon was designed, the robot was built in order to overcome the obstacles that for a long time made this operation impossible from the point of view of the operatives, from the point of view of Israeli Mossad, the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Service. Israel had assassinated few Iranian nuclear scientists. Some were killed, some were injured. And another high-ranked general at the Revolutionary Guard in charge of the R&D of missiles was also killed together with 16 of his soldiers. Most of those assassinations took place when an operative sitting on a motorcycle was riding it next to the car of the scientist, usually in the streets of Tehran, and either stick had like a sort of a small sticky bomb attached to the car, which he detonated shortly after when he got a little bit further away, or pulled the gun and killed the scientist. The Iranians learned the lesson. They figured out that their number one scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was running the nuclear project, is probably, will be probably, the next target. And they have made him one of the most guarded, if not the most guarded person in Iran. And they, the whole structure, the whole envelope of the security details, a convoy of armored cars from 4 to 7 vehicles, the best Revolutionary Guard security personnel, trained, heavily armed, everything was planned in order to make sure that even if a motorcycle is, for whatever reason, successful in getting close to this convoy, he will not get away from there alive. In Mossad, there is an ironclad rule. The same weight is attributed to the success of the operation and the success of the evacuation of the team. If there's no safe way to evacuate, then there's no operation. And it was clear that in any kind of scenario, either with a motorcycle or exploding a bomb on the road that would stop the convoy and then start hitting the cars or the car of Fakhrizadeh with snipers, any kind of that scenario would end up in a gunfight, and a gunfight that nobody can predict how will end. So the question or the problem that gave birth to the robot was how to perform the assassination, but make sure that there are no assassins, there are no operatives around the scene, because if there are, they are going to get in that gunfight. And then the robot was planned. And the robot was planned in order to take the human factor out of the decision-making process of approving the operation. Once there is no risk to the operatives, then the whole decision-making process looks different. The robot is built, weighs all the components together, something like 1 ton. It is composed of 7.62mm FN machine gun, special version for snipers. That machine gun is attached to a sophisticated, complex system of computers, hydraulic wheels, cameras that covers not just the front of the robot, of course, where the gun is pointed out, but 360 degrees, sees everything around in order to try and prevent collateral damage, and the equipment needed to encrypt the signal and send it to the satellite and get the signal back. This was disassembled to its smallest parts, and through almost a year, smuggled into Iran, reassembled, recalibrated, synced, and then put on a vehicle called Zamyad. Zamyad is a local manufacturer of Nissan, like a pickup, stashed hidden in the back part of the vehicle, of the car, and was placed on the rode on the last, after the last turn towards the vacation, the weekend vacation house of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, just hours before he arrived there, after he left his previous post. So when the operatives learned that he and the convoy are on their way to Absard, the village, they put the Zamyad, make sure that all the gear is working, connection with the satellite, everything is synchronized, and left the scene.
All right. And just to be clear, you started this conversation with a quip about the Day of the Jackal, which has a remote control machine gun, and I believe the film was made in the 1960s or 70s. How is this robot different from just a remote control machine gun, which could have been built at any time from the time a radio was created until, I mean, obviously it's quite sophisticated, but what is the sort of specifically robotic component of this that is operating autonomously, and what is the remote control element?
Yeah. So the first, the remote control machine guns are in use in few armies in the world, the Israeli, the Russian, the American. This is not new, but the quality of those weapons significantly improved in the last decade because of the ability to control and make sure that the shooting is as precise as possible. And this is based on few technologies that did not exist before. But all of that, all of those weapons are operated from a command center that is maybe yards or miles away. That's it. So very, very nearby. And in this case, in this assassination, everything was different. The sniper, the one moving or maneuvering the machine gun, was sitting in a command room more than 1,000 miles away. The signal, when it leaves the Zamyad, the vehicle, the pickup, and goes to the satellite and down to the war room, this takes 0.8 seconds. Then, of course, the sniper, even, you know, the most skilled one, has to take or will take some time to digest what he sees on the monitor and reach a conclusion and order the joystick what to do next.
Just to be clear, 0.8 seconds is a lot when you're dealing with a fast-moving vehicle.
Yes.
At long range.
Yeah. So 0.8 to the command center, some time for the sniper to think, 0.8 to back, so at least 2 seconds. And then what the machine receives, what the robot receives, is completely not relevant because the car is moving. The artificial intelligence of the robot is able to compensate for the loss of time, for those delays, to calculate what and understand what exactly the sniper wishes to hit and calculate the differences in how to move the machine gun and also compensate for the moving of the machine gun after the first shooting from the recoil. This is a very, very sophisticated machine, of course, that was tested many, many times. And this is the only way how, from the point of view of the operatives, this was done successfully and, again, with no collateral damage.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
So I want to emphasize this latter point on the recoil. When you fire a gun any gun, there is some degree of recoil that in a normal situation, a human has to then compensate for by the time, you know, stabilize the weapon in time to take a second shot. In this case, the human can't do that because he's 1,000 miles away. So in addition to compensating for the time lag, the machine is compensating for recoil in what turned out to be a rapid fire of 15 rounds. Is that right?
Yes. And usually in the places where armies are using automatic machine guns, they are rooted to the ground in something by far more significant than a car. It's like usually a tower that is less sensitive to recoil than a car, than, you know, whatever it weighs and how much you try to attach it to the ground, but it still moves. And all of that had to be calculated into the building of the robot. And of course, while at the same time not making it too big or too heavy, so the operatives can smuggle it into Iran, assemble it, and put it in the scene.
Let's talk about the target. Unlike Qasem Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh is not a household name, or was not in Iran, although Bibi Netanyahu, when he was prime minister and spoke at the UN, referred to him by name several times, as you guys note in the story. Who was he, and why were the Israelis so keen on taking him out?
According to Israeli intelligence, and this is corroborated by American intelligence and also by many documents produced by the IAEA, United Nations Agency, and a resolution of the United Nations from 2006 to freeze the assets of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. So according to all of those entities, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was the number one nuclear scientist and was running the secret, hidden, denied military path of the Iranian nuclear project. Iran denied, still denying, that it ever had a military angle to its nuclear project, claiming that the only purpose was scientific and for peaceful purposes. I think that there is a consensus, without getting into too many details, there is a consensus in the world today that Iran had a military project headed by Mohsen Fakhrizadeh at least until 2003. In 2018, the Israeli Mossad stole the secret archive of Project Amad, which is the code name for this military angle of the nuclear project. This is the Project Amad, is the one that the late Fakhrizadeh was running. In the folders and hundreds of thousands of documents and disks and other records, there are notes, handwritten notes, and many, many, many imprints of Fakhrizadeh in his writing or his transcripts and orders in the meetings of the highest command of the Iranian nuclear project. My colleague David Sanger and myself 3 years ago were allowed access to this trove of documents. And the trove of documents was, again, corroborated by the New York Times and by others. And in that, we saw the handwriting of Mr. Fakhrizadeh on documents and giving orders that leave very little space or room for doubts. What is the purpose of that project? What is what Ahmad was doing? Now, there is a question, there is a in contradiction in views or the analysis of intelligence between Israel that claims that in 2003, Project Amad was disassembled just to be reassembled under another name, and that Fakhrizadeh was running the military nuclear project until the day he died on the 27th of November 2020. There are many who do not agree and believe, including in the U.S., and believe that that part of the project was frozen. Iranians, they say, indeed lied about what happened until 2003 and did not come clean after the signing of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, in 2015. But yet, the danger, I think, those people believe is less critical or less urgent than the one the Israelis portray. Whatever view you choose, it's clear that the late Mr. Fakhrizadeh was taking a profound role in the nuclear and missile projects of Iran. And thanks to the great work of my colleague Farnas Fasihi, she was able for the first time to bring Iranian officials, for the first time admitting that he was running an illegal network of smuggling of equipment for the nuclear and missile project into Iran, equipment that Iran was forbidden from importing, and that he was a high-ranked commander at the Revolutionary Guard, and that he was deeply involved as not just as a scientist, but as the head of those projects. The Iranians, I think today, after he died, are not trying anymore to hide his role, but are trying to create him as yet another myth, so another myth like the late Soleimani. And they are bringing out more and more information. And so from the point of view of Israel, following what was termed in 1981 as the Begin Doctrine, Menachem Begin was Israeli prime minister back then, and he ordered the Israeli, first the Israeli Mossad, to try to stop the Iraqi nuclear military project by means of sabotage and assassination. And when that didn't work anymore, he ordered the Israeli Air Force to raid the Tammuz Osirak reactor by Baghdad and destroy it. And Menachem Begin termed that doctrine and said, Israel will never allow a country that calls for its destruction to acquire the means to deliver such annihilation. And I think not just Benjamin Netanyahu, any Israeli prime minister was holding that doctrine and will continue to hold it. And the campaign to kill nuclear scientists, which is not the first campaign that the Mossad is executing against nuclear scientists, they were German scientists working for Egypt in the 60s. There were Iraqi scientists in the 70s, and now the Iranian scientists. This is all part of this overall strategy to do whatever necessary in order to stop what is seen, and I'm not getting into the debate here whether it's true or not, but what is seen by Israel, by Israelis, and this is high on the consensus, as an existential threat, as something with the potential to deliver another Holocaust.
So you are also the author of a book, which I highly recommend to readers. The book is called Rise and Kill First, which is a history of Israeli targeted killings. So this story fits into a much longer train of reporting that you've done. You describe in this conversation, this as a matter of kind of Israeli doctrine since Menachem Begin and in some ways longer ago than that. But it's also a set of actions that Israel does not formally acknowledge because it is almost certainly in violation of international law. And because, as you point out, these scientists are not generally combatants, although yeah. Fakhrizadeh was apparently a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. They're not combatants. This set of operations has a very dubious status under the law of armed conflict. And I'm curious these operations are conducted by the Mossad, not by the IDF. How are they understood in relation to the law by Israel, which is, among other things, a rule of law society.
Yep. When came the time to give the book to which I devoted 8 years of, more than 8 years of my life to research, the book that detailed the history of targeted killing as a main weapon by Israel, we had all sorts of names suggested. One of them was, the obvious, License to Kill. But then it turns out that there are 65 different books already called License to Kill. So we said, we're not going to be that one. And then someone came with the lame idea. This was me. And I suggested The Art of Assassinations, like The Art of War of Sun Tzu. This is a very, really, really bad idea. People will think it's like a coaching book and nobody would read it. And then someone who was really privy to read the transcript, the tens of millions of words of transcripts of the interviews I did with 1,000 interviewees. So more than 1,000 interviews, because some of them I had to meet a few times. And he said, Ronan, there is one sentence that many of your different interviewees keep on repeating. And of course, they are not synchronized. They don't update each other about this coming interview. But they do quote the same phrase from the Babylonian Talmud. And the phrase is, whoever comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. Hakam le'orgecha, Hashkem le'orgo. Whoever comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. And I think this, the fact that those interviewees quoted the Babylonian Talmud was not in order to impress me with their knowledge with the Jewish scripture. They wanted to show, they wanted to explain to the readers, I'm just, of course, the pipeline, why they have done those operations way beyond enemy lines, very risky to themselves, to others, and of course, very controversial legally and morally, because they believe that this was the only possibility. There was no other choice. And now, connecting to your question, I think that the perception in Israel that was generally accepted by the Supreme Court in its dramatic decision in 2006 by then the president of the Supreme Court, Judge Aaron Barak, to term as legal the use of targeted killings in specific cases. But the general view of those is more or less, if to simplify things, of course it's much more difficult or much more complicated, but to simplify things, it's that necessity of self-defense. You walk in the street, someone is pointing a gun at you, you pull out the gun in order to defend yourself. Now, the U.S. has dealt with that differently. By the way, some of the principles that Aaron Barak, the judge Aaron Barak, termed at that verdict were adopted by the legal consultants of the CIA. But Israel did not adopt the differences that the U.S. has made between assassinations and targeted killings. I remember once giving a speaking engagement, speaking together on stage with General Michael Hayden, the former head of the NSA and the CIA. And I said something about assassinations. And he said, no, Ronan, we are not performing assassinations. Those are targeted killings.
So this is a distinction that Israelis do not make.
Yeah. For the Israelis, these are just mere words that some kind of verbal gymnastics that was made by lawyers in order to enable the CIA to do what it was not permitted to do after the presidential order in the 70s. But from the point of view, once a person like Fakhrizadeh is seen as running a project that is clear and present danger to Israel, then according to the Israeli understanding of the law, he is a is a legitimate target. And I'm not saying it's my view. I'm just saying, I'm just trying to explain the Israeli view.
Understood that you are reporting on doctrine here, not endorsing it. But I just want to suggest that the work that the U.S. legal distinction between assassinations and targeted killing does is not limited to verbal gymnastics. It would actually preclude the killing of a scientist, because in the U.S. version of it, the target has to be an operational, legitimate target under the law of war. Otherwise, it would be an assassination, which is illegal. And so one of the things that the Israeli doctrine that you're describing, one of the pieces of work that it does, is it collapses the distinction between a combatant and a civilian. Yes. If the person is posing right. a threat through their work. Is that right?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. And I would say taking or involving the legal consultants, whether of the Shin Bet, the Domestic Secret Service, or the Mossad, the Foreign Intelligence Agency, or the IDF, their advices are usually at need when the discussion is about a nearby targeted killing, which will immediately be attributed to Israel. It will be very hard to deny, and the risk, usually those are done by aircrafts or means that present a by far greater danger for collateral damage. Again, from the Israeli point of view, the entity approving the targeted killing, which is the prime minister, with the sort of advisory board of some other ministers, after seeing the forum of the heads of the intelligence community, they are looking mainly at the threat posed by the target and the possible outcomes, and of course the risk to the operatives as much as there is one, and the possible outcomes of the assassination. And the differences between a civilian and an illegal combatant that is working or that is operating in a war zone, those are less important. And they are even less important by the Supreme Court, when legislating this, the Supreme Court was speaking about no alternative possibility for arrest, prime minister authorizing, and proportionality. Proportionality is, of course, a very general term. You can put everything into it and analyze it in any way you want.
We are going to leave it there. Ronen Bergman, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you for inviting me to your podcast.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, our audio engineer. This episode is the intrepid Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast on all the social medias. Leave us a rating review wherever you found us. Buy our merch at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. If you want to avoid the ads, you can do so by becoming a material supporter of Lawfare on our Patreon page. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.